Was Starship Flight 13 a success? Yes, no. What are the nuances we should be looking at?
The cost decline for inference at the frontier is kind of, on like my most recent calculation, it's 97-fold annualized.
I don't see the case for many businesses wanting to use a Chinese model.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Brainstorm. Today, we are down, Sam, but Tasha is here. Brett, as always, we are talking Starship, SpaceX, and then we are going to look at the AI frontier because we cannot go a single episode without talking about AI. It's too important. Okay, Brett, Tasha, was Starship Flight 13 a success? Yes, no. What are the nuances we should be looking at?
I would say, okay, so was it a success? Yes. Did they do everything they wanted? No. They wanted a soft landing for both the booster and the ship. They got a soft landing on the ship. The booster had a hard splashdown, but overall, like a number of improvements since the last test flight. And they, including, they got 20 real satellites out. They were active for about 20 minutes. They got a bunch of data back from them. They got more images of the heat shield. They also relit an engine in space on the ship to test that capability for the next mission. And for the next test mission, they plan to go fully orbital and to attempt a catch of the ship, which will be the first.
And they've already caught the booster? Yes.
Yes. Yes. A couple of times, right?
Yeah.
They come in a couple of times and caught it.
Yes. Yeah. But they're doing the splashdowns because they're suborbital flights. So it's like a hop versus a full circle.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And they redesigned the booster and the ship basically for this new variant. And this is the variant they're going to go to space with their V3 satellites on. And as Tasha alluded to, the new engines, some of them didn't relight to create a soft splashdown for the booster. So they still have some engineering work to do. But I think that the hardest engineering challenge, at least that we had anticipated, was whether or not you can make that heat shield reusable on the Starship. And from that perspective, this was a wildly successful flight, as in optically the heat shield came down, their first flight of the Starship, it was like burning through. It was like, something out of Interstellar or something as it was coming in to land, and it barely kind of flopped into the ocean. This one seemed, quite successful. It landed so softly that it didn't even explode as it fell over. And the optically, the heat shield looked like it was in great shape. Now, I'm sure it wasn't perfect, but it seems like they're really narrowing in and tuning in on what that can look like. And so from a modeling perspective, we really didn't anticipate in any meaningful sense that they would have a fully reusable stack until 2027, until kind of like mid-2027. And even that would be slightly ahead of schedule relative to the balance of how we modeled the company. So if they can make this fully reusable earlier, it means they can lower their costs to orbit from hundreds of dollars per kilogram to, around 100 or 100 or less. And so then that preserves capital for the company to devote to satellite manufacturing and spinning up kind of all of their production facilities. And so it really impacts the financial model for the company in a pretty big way, on the order of, depending on kind of like when they actually get it into reuse, it could kind of double or more expectations for 2036 and, on the order of a 20 to 40% increase in our expectations for earnings in 2031. So I would say that it's, in terms of like their various de-risking things that SpaceX has to do, this is the first and some would say it's impossible to create a rapid reusable top stage. So this is a milestone along the way, and it's a positive milestone, but by no means are they all the way there. I think that's how I'd think about it.
Tasha. Yes. Yes. And so, and you touched on it, Brett, but just to make crystal clear, so the importance of the soft splashdown and the fact that, you know, this is not like a charred ship like last time, is that now they get a lot more information back from it. You know, they can go and see what happened, and there's things that are still intact. Sort of every test flight, they get a lot of information back to fix things for the next time. So that's, I think that's a huge, huge milestone.
I have two questions. It sounds like the heat shield is, you know, what you're focused on or what needs, you know, potential problem solving. How do you think about the potential for, yes, you have a heat shield and it might work once, but does it work 2, 3, 4 times versus, you know, what is the cost to replace maybe 25% of their tiles, right? Like their fitted right. tiles. Like if you have to replace 25%, can you do that fast enough to then launch the ship within like a day or two? How do you think about the cost associated with like a fully reusable heat shield versus like a partially reusable heat shield?
Well, their goal is for no refurb. So basically it's just 100%. Like an airplane. Yes, you can launch it again. So aside from just like the cost of like tiles themselves, it's like just the time that it would take to reinstall type of thing. So that's the ultimate goal.
Okay.
But practically the way we model it is kind of like the first time they reuse it, they spend one, it's like the cost of rebuilding the ship, you know, it is part of the driver of how much we model it costing to refurbish the ship. If you have to spend a whole year refurbishing it, we model that as being like, you might as well just build the whole thing from scratch again, you know? And so when they begin to reuse it, the midpoint is that it'll take them, you know, basically 3 months to refurbish it. And then it declines on a learning rate from there. And I think that if you look at kind of like what's happened with the Falcon 9, you know, it's now they can turn them in kind of 20 days. But a lot of that is because they're landing them on a barge. They have to barge it back to the spot. You know, they have to get it tipped, you know, like into the facility. So a lot of the design of this is to, it's really to land right on the launch pad so it can take off again. We'll see if it's, I would suspect first it'll be, yes, it lands on the launch pad. Then they crane it off into the facility. Sure. They inspect it. You know, maybe they patch up some things. Then they put it back. And over time, they're trying to get to this, like an airplane cadence. But it's certainly not how we model.
Won't be immediate.
Is the heat, this may be a dumb question, but is the heat shield only on the ship portion of the rocket and not the booster? And so Falcon 9, this is not applicable to it because you don't need the heat shield for the booster because it's just falling straight down. So it's not hitting as much drag and causing as much of a fireball. Is that the idea?
I mean, the top stage, because it goes all the way into orbit, it has to
come back
burn off a lot more energy on the way back.
Gotcha.
And so the bottom stage, you know, just doesn't get going as fast as the top, which takes the bottom stage and takes all of its energy and then, you know, boosts itself on a much lighter load even further. And so then that's why it's so much more challenging to bring the top stage back.
Got it. And parachutes, they don't solve any of this? Can you just...
Well, I mean, there's like China is doing this, like we're catching it in a net type thing. And when the Falcon 9 program first began and they went after this, we're going to land it vertically. People claimed that was an insanely dumb thing to do because you'd be better off with like parachutes and you hook it with a helicopter coming across or something. So you never let it kind of come all the way down. The claim was that would be a more efficient and economical way to do it. The problem with that technique is it doesn't help you in landing on the moon or Mars. Because Mars doesn't have a thick enough atmosphere. And so if your ultimate goal is to get to Mars, you have to master this technology anyway. And so then that's why, you know, reputedly Elon pushed for this as the design solution at that time, which is, you know, it's kind of, there is this funny characteristic of SpaceX in particular, where they're going after something that is so much farther than what anybody else is designing for, that then they create this like extraterrestrial technology that turns out to be very useful back on Earth. And so like nobody aiming at like the narrow point of like, hey, let's just make this rocket barely reusable would have done the land on its butt thing in the first place. But the fact that they mastered that one, it's like much harder. So nobody else has really been able to replicate it. You know, Blue Origin is beginning to. Here we are a decade plus later. And it just means they have like a much bigger like step change advantage than anybody else does. Mm-hmm. Or than they otherwise would, I should say.
Yeah. And in general, like the company ethos is to look for the simplest solution possible, just sort of like delete anything that you might not necessarily need.
Yeah. And so as we look forward, Flight 14, what should people look out for? What is the goal, 14 versus 13? What's the next step?
Well, 14 is the first fully. So these up until now, it's been suborbital. So this is the first orbital flight. And again, they plan to try to catch the ship for the first time. So that would be a major milestone in terms of, you know, this goal of full reusability.
It would be the first, kind of thing that went into orbit that safely came back since the space shuttle, I think. I mean, that's not totally true. I mean, I guess these, you know, the capsules come back, but it's like basically the first like designed orbital, like truly orbital object that's designed to come back and take off and come back and take off. And I assume because they would be going into orbit, they actually would be able to launch satellites that would stay up, as opposed to just being up for 20 minutes. So it could actually deliver meaningfully commercial bandwidth into space for them. On a net basis, they're going to launch 20x more bandwidth per Starship full stack as they are currently launching for every Falcon 9 rocket.
Yes.
And so, it really, transforms like the capability of delivering connectivity to people that they'll have in pretty short order if they're able to commercialize that, even if they can't get the top stage reusable. Like we have like modeled scenarios where that never works and it's still, you know, it costs them more money to get there, but it doesn't change the fact that the Starlink business is this amazing commercial opportunity. Mm-hmm.
Okay, switching topics, Brett, Kimi K3, the frontier of AI. Where are we headed here? How much cheaper is this going to get on a knowledge basis?
Oh, well, yeah, actually, that's an interesting. So I was just doing some work. So remember, cast yourself back to maybe it was a year and a half ago, DeepSeek came out. Do you remember when DeepSeek came out?
I think the whole market remembers when
the DeepSeek was the chatbot that was going to end the Frontier Labs dominance. And like, oh, as it turns out, Chinese companies can do this on fewer chips. And so then therefore NVIDIA's toast, and as well as like, what do we need all this compute for? All of these things are basically going to be commoditized anyway. And here we are again. Here we are again. Now, if you look at what DeepSeek has done since then, it's being used in China. That's half of its use. It's being used, you know, in other kind of emerging market countries. But it certainly has not dented kind of like the uptake of Gemini or ChatGPT or Claude. The idea is that Kimi offering this kind of like agentic experience is also going to destroy and eat up kind of the frontier model companies. And, you know, maybe it's still good for an NVIDIA because you still need chips to infer these things. And maybe it's okay for the infrastructure as a service providers, which I agree, because you still need tokens no matter what. But why would I pay the same amount for a service from an American lab when I can run the service myself on my own infrastructure or on my own AWS instance from a Chinese company? That's essentially the state of controversy today. Nick, did I miscast it?
No, I think that's exactly it. I would add the one caveat, which it does seem, and you know, Brett, you've been very focused on this, but the frontier itself seems to be getting more crowded, not less. As in the performance jumps of these model companies, the gap that they're, you know, leapfrogging each other is closing each time. So like the performance improvement is not as big as it used to be 1 or 2 years ago. So it seems like you're having more models that are close to or near the frontier than there was maybe 2 years ago. So as much as it's
disagree with that. I disagree with that. I think now one thing that happens is like you set out a benchmark and you say, oh, well, I'm up here on this benchmark. These other guys are catching up. But that's depends on your y-axis scaling of that benchmark. But if you look at like the more agentic benchmarks, for example, DeepSui 1.1, which is a software engineering benchmark, one, the inference, the cost decline for inference at the frontier is kind of on like my most recent calculation, it's 97-fold annualized, meaning kind of like you could today be like, do you know what? I can save myself, you know, maybe even 5% by switching to this Chinese model, or I could wait a year and I could end up with a, you know, 97-fold cost decline. Why would I even bother with the engineering effort to change if I can just like sit on a provider that I trust and then they're going to deliver me this magical performance advantage where I keep doing the same corporate actions and my cost of doing those actions falls by 97-fold. So, and if you look, like we're still not, there's still like a high error rate relative to that benchmark, but that error rate is improving over time. So right now, I think the top end models have like a, they're scoring in the low 70% in terms of performance. If you max, if you turn to like max or, you know, they have different pro or, you know, and, but if you look over time, like actually that error rate is going to get compressed. And yes, that benchmark then is going to get, you know, toward saturation and kind of call it a year and a half, if you're kind of maximizing your spend. So I think there is this question, and Nick, you're kind of on the other side of this. It's like, how much intelligence do you really need? Like, if I can, you know, maximize this bench, I don't need like an expert software engineer in my job. So why would I even spend the money for those tokens? And my perspective is it unlocks them doing lots of things for you, in efficient and effective way, that otherwise you wouldn't have access to. Right?
Yes. And I do think we're on opposite sides of the spectrum. Like, I think the frontier is obviously extremely, extremely important. But I think the majority of use cases for everyday life at this point, at least from a knowledge worker perspective, can be accomplished by the models that are 1 or 2 years old. Now, there is the claim that you make, Brett, which is, well, work is going to change. And that work is going to be, you know, facilitated by these agentic frontier models. And I totally agree with you. I just am trying to, in my own head, understand how big is that market versus the, you know, call it 85 to 90% of tasks that can already be handled for the most part by like very cheap older models.
Well, that's actually a question I had. So like, yes, there's switching costs, right? But then also it's like, what, assuming that you're willing to overcome the switching cost barrier, like how much do you really think is like at risk, so to speak, for like a cheaper Chinese or cheaper open source model? Because it's like, yes, a lot of, you can imagine like many everyday questions could be answered with any model, but like the more complex work that sort of like uses more tokens, et cetera, you are, you know, then you assume again, higher switching costs, you want sort of the latest model. So like what is up for grabs for sort of siphoning off? Do you know what I mean? Of all the work,
I think there's I think two ways to think about the market. One is like, as you're describing it, Nick, it's basically like capability of the model screams past what you need. And so then therefore you say, well, I could do this for $10 or I could do it for $1. Why not just do it for a dollar? You know? And I think that ignores, like, there's one aspect that clearly ignores, which is business is generally positive sum in aggregate, but zero sum in competition. So if you can spend $10 to beat your competitor and your competitor is willing to only spend $1 and get beaten, well, have fun, guy. You're dead.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's kind of like if like the economy can grow dynamically. Like one of the things I've been thinking about, I've been traveling, right? And so I use ChatGPT all the time, sometimes Grok, to be like, where should we go for dinner? Right. And it gives me a suggestion. It doesn't give me 10 suggestions. It's like, this is where you should go. And maybe it gives it a second one, a second suggestion. It does so by looking at TripAdvisor and by looking at, like, you know, sometimes random blog sites. That means for these restaurants, the one that is the top suggestion for those circumstances is actually going to collect a bigger share, I think, of market than it otherwise would when you're confronted with, well, TripAdvisor, there's five restaurants, I'm choosing between them. Now I'm choosing between one or two. And so then suddenly, like, those businesses are in competition with each other. The business next door that isn't getting any traffic, they're like, why? You know, whereas their neighbor is super competitive, they need to figure out how to actually successfully market themselves to these AI chatbots. And so what's the way to, like, maximize, like, your visibility on AI chatbots? It's to have an AI agent run your marketing for your business. And so all these companies, like, in competition with each other will be, have to be counter positioning. And you could argue that actually AI will just, the frontier models will soak up all of, like, the excess profitability of these companies as they're positioning themselves against each other. And I think that that's like a, there's certainly like some truth to that, as in, if I enter into a lawsuit with someone, you know, I pay for the best lawyer because, like, I need to basically win. And a lot of business is just winning against competition. And so underspending will doom yourself to bankruptcy.
And I agree with you. I guess I agree with you to a certain extent, as in, like, I fully understand what you're saying, but I also just see this as, look, as a business, right, if you want to create a new revenue source or income stream, right, you're going to say, okay, I need to deploy my best people to this, figure this out, stand this business up. And then once it's stood up, you bring in people to just repeat the process over and over and over and over and over again. And that's how you have reoccurring revenue coming in off of a business. So, like, you can think of that for a frontier model versus, like, a distilled model that comes after it, which is, like, you use the frontier to, like, open this business opportunity up for yourself. And then you say to a new model, you go, hey, see what that model did? Just do that as many times as possible until the revenue, like, until there's diminishing returns. And so, like, I agree with you. And maybe it's that you're going to have so many people using frontier models that you'll never hit a wall of new and exciting opportunities to deploy frontier models against. But that also means that the opportunity for distilled open source models that, you know, come after the frontier, like, that's an enormous opportunity in and of itself. So I think maybe I'm just, like, I'm bullish both, right?
Yeah.
But I'm still trying to understand, like,
how the dynamic. And I do agree with you, like, as in, I think it's a nice way to think about it. Like, I'm spinning up a business, I'm going after something new. I get it. Now I convert it into a process that I'm trying to repeat. The business dynamism is going to increase here. Like, the reason I described the restaurant thing is because I think more and more of the world will look like power law curved, where it's like the rewards to winning will actually expand quite a bit. And the rewards to being in the long tail will be somewhat uniform, but it'll just get longer and longer and longer. And so you'll be in this, like, commoditized competition with everybody. And so people will try to spend a boatload to just, like, get up onto the steep part of the curve, or they'll be sitting in this kind of, like, sea of interchangeability where it's all just repeating task. And there they will be in interchangeable model land. So I think that, like, if you look at how, kind of at least one way we model kind of, like, the trickle down economics of $7 trillion in AI software spend is, like, a big chunk, $2 trillion goes to foundation model companies. Another $2 trillion goes to platform as a service, where kind of Palantir and kind of the open weight models live. And so it kind of, like, models it as a rough split between the two. I feel like that's as good a guess as any. I can understand why consultants are looking at Kimi and being like, ooh, we get to help people fine tune this model, whereas before we couldn't. And so you should definitely do this, because then that'll line my pocket rather than somebody else's. Don't go for this cookie cutter solution from the frontier labs. If you fine tune, you'll be great. But, like, the cost and the performance improvement is so steep and dramatic here. I think a lot of businesses are going to be like, we're sticking with these vendors that we've kind of already validated in. And yes, it's a bake-off, but like going with this Chinese model presents its own set of risks. What if the federal government comes in and says, you can't use it? You know, there's just like ways in which, and like, not to mention some kind of hidden backdoor, but ways in which that, particular, like a model from those particular sources will be perceived as risky, which will kind of hold off that as a competitive vector. So I think it'll be, you know, it's not that it's going to be meaningless. It's more like similar to DeepSeek. It's going to exist and be a meaningful like thing that's out there. But I would expect that the frontier labs will continue to capture a huge amount of economic value. And also that where we are in kind of the capability of these systems is spend will continue to concentrate, you know, somewhere on the curve of the frontier.
Yeah. Tasha, where do you land on this?
Well, it seems like, I don't see the case for many businesses wanting to use a Chinese model. So like if that's the majority of knowledge work, then sort of it exists. The reason it's meaningful is because it's sort of like, you know, pushing everyone further to try to optimize on, both performance and cost. So from that perspective, meaningful. But yeah, that was where I was, what I was trying to get at in terms of my question of like, what actual like share of the work is at risk here?
Yeah.
Seems low, but that's my thought.
Yeah.
And, you know, every player who is incentivized to has come out in favor of open weight models. It's like NVIDIA. So I think the interpretation the market had that this is bad for AI CapEx, I think is just totally asinine. Like that's clearly wrong. And that's why Amazon and NVIDIA is like, yes, open weight models. Like that would like concentrate economic power to them and away from the frontier lab companies. So they're clearly trying to, you know, hamstring the companies that are at the frontier. And you can tell that they think it would be great for spend as well. And in aggregate, you know, it just is interesting to me, these kind of periodic freakouts that, you know, I think we'll be past it in a couple weeks or a month or so. So,
yeah, and we're going through one right now. So with that, we will end. Thank you all for listening. If you have questions, put it in the comments. We'll try and get to them next week. But thank you all so much.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.